Blog Talk Radio.
We've switched our times to 7 p.m. on Tuesdays, so this will be our regular show time from now on, and this is our first Tuesday show. Today we'll be talking about solitude and how it can be very frightening to some people, but to us, we think that it can be a necessary part of life that is actually enriching and meaningful if approached in the right way. But I'm just going to have you check out our website if you want to check out any of our articles that relate to our show today. Our website is ethicstalk.cmish.edu. And please feel free to call in if you have any stories or questions or anything to add to the conversation. Our number is 646-727-3928. I'm going to start out the conversation by asking Amanda, why solitude is such a frightening concept?
Well, thanks, Emily. It's great to be back on the show again. Like Emily said, today we're sort of taking the side that solitude is a good thing and can be meaningful for people. So to answer your question, why is solitude such a frightening concept, I have to kind of think in somebody else's shoes because, at least for me, solitude isn't really frightening per se. So to think how solitude may be frightening or bad to somebody else, I sort of think that maybe it's the case that solitude is only unappealing to people who do not know what to do with their free time. In a way, other people can be a form of distraction for you and also, in some cases, a means of entertainment. So take, for example, today on TV, there are various news programs that are solely focused on reporting and showing the affairs of movie stars and singers, etc., because that is like entertainment for other people. So and it's obviously the case that these shows continue to remain popular as they continue to grow and new shows are coming up all the time. So I guess for this point that I'm making, solitude, I guess, again, to reiterate, would only be unappealing because they don't know what to do with their free time. And so those types of people may indulge in checking out what other people are doing on those news programs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I also think that solitude can be really scary for people who find meaning in other people. Like, for instance, the parent who gets all of their meaning and fulfillment through the lives of their children. So they're catering to their children and everything, and they go to their soccer practice, and they take them to Girl Scouts and stuff like that, and they don't really have life outside of children. So when the kids are at school or the kids move away, they don't know what to do with their alone time, and it's very scary. Or another example would be like the boyfriend and girlfriend who are always together, and then one of them goes on vacation and the other one doesn't really know what to do because their meaning is wrapped up in this one person. So I think that relationships can make solitude very scary as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree. It definitely seems like those people are taking a much more passive approach in terms of their own solitude because their meaning is sort of tied up in other people. And again, to reiterate the TV shows or even Facebook for that matter, you have people that go on Facebook for the sole reason of checking out what other people are doing, to look at their pictures, like catch up on their lives. There's also people that like read those trash tabloid magazines, you know, granted maybe they're entertaining, but I guess that's pretty much it. It is very passive. They're not taking like an active role in finding like an activity. Mm-hmm. that will lead further to their own growth as an,
right.
as a person.
Right, and I think that as far as those TV shows go and Facebook and MySpace, all you're seeing about these people's lives is them or are them being social. And you see on TV, like, all the stars surrounded by all their friends, and on Facebook, all of your friends with all of their friends and their photo albums, and you never really see the person as alone. So it's almost like in your mind you're thinking, people are always with everyone else. I need to be with everyone else too. So I can't be alone. You know, it's almost like a false belief, because at some point everyone is alone. They have to be, you know.
Definitely. Yeah, and just to go on, again, to answer this question, I think that some people would report on being alone as boring. I mean, you talk to some people and they say, like, I'm always bored, I have nothing to do, blah, blah, blah. And I think that some researchers would submit that these individuals sort of lack the ability to self-regulate, or I guess another way of putting it is, like, coming up with your own stuff. This could also mean that an individual like that, well, I guess to put it another way, is deficient in finding meaningful activities to participate in on his or her own. So again, this is taking a passive approach. It actually brings to mind a movie that I've recently watched, and I know that you have watched as well. In this movie, Revolutionary Road, starring Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, I'm thinking of a scene that occurred between the two of them. In this film, they are playing husband and wife, and in the scene that I'm thinking of, they are having an argument, a disagreement about what it is that their lives hold for them. And basically, they had originally made a plan, and this plan is now changed, mainly because the husband, Leonardo DiCaprio, in the movie, his name is Frank, has sort of decided to take a job promotion, and I think that, you know, well, obviously that was for various reasons anyway, it's sort of irrelevant, but in this conversation, he says to her, look, like, I'm not going to run away from my responsibilities. Like, it takes backbone to, like own up to your responsibilities. And she, her response to him is, it takes backbone to lead the life that you want. Mm-hmm. And I think that that statement is so profound, because that really says it all. And one way of interpreting the statement, the way that I'm thinking about it right now, is that basically anything worth doing in life takes some gumption. It takes some energy in order to be done. And so going back to that whole idea of passive versus active, just thinking in terms of your own solitude, making your solitude meaningful takes energy. It takes gumption.
Right.
And so she would say, like, okay, if you want your solitude to be meaningful, then, you know, get up the gumption to do so.
And I think, yeah, like, it's like that for everything in your life. You do have to work at finding things that are enjoyable for you. You have to try different things, and you have to dedicate yourself to things for a while and see if it plays out. And it's difficult to find things to fill your alone time if you don't have the imagination or the creativity to do so, or the guts to do so.
Well, not only that, but just thinking, okay, so say you have this hypothetical person, and this person has some free time. Okay, say it's a Sunday afternoon, and they're like, what am I going to do with my free time? Well, this person, basically, the way I see it, has one of two choices. That person can either fill their time with some passive activity, like watching TV, or searching on Facebook or whatever, doing something that you're sort of just absorbing and you're not really doing. Or that person could seek out an activity that may require you to develop some skill in order to do it. One idea is, like, playing the guitar. Like, obviously when you start doing, like, something like that for the first time, you're not going to know how to do it. It's like something that takes time. You're not going to learn it right away. It takes some energy, some patience, which sort of goes against our default motivational system, if you will. Like, obviously, we're sort of on default to be lazy, to be like, you know, whatever, passive. And it's sort of, you sort of have to like overcome that in order to have a meaningful solitude. But I think people that do would be likely to say that they were glad that they did it.
Yeah, and it is easy, like you were saying, taking up guitar. You know, at first you're not going to be good at it, so you're going to want to quit. And that's what I meant when I was saying, like, I guess I didn't say perseverance, but you're going to have that in order to fill your alone time with something meaningful. And
yeah, so I'll just say a couple other things that came to mind in answering this question, and then I'll give you the opportunity to say what you had to say. So another reason that I think some may not enjoy their solitude, or they'll think it's quote-unquote frightening, is that when you're alone, you basically have no other choice but to deal with yourself. In other words, being alone allows your mind to reflect on the experiences that you are having in life. And if you live your life full of, like, inconsistencies and without meaning, then you may not particularly enjoy reflecting on that.
Right. Right. Your alone time could be filled with regrets and negative private speech.
Yeah. I think the term that is used in flow, and I intended to bring this up later, is psychic entropy.
Mm-hmm.
I did also want to point out that during our conversation, we are going to be referring to the book Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, as we have sort of based a lot of our conversation on solitude on this book, as it relates to having an optimal experience and how your solitude can be incorporated with that. Anyway, Flow, and this term psychic entropy, it's basically described as like a disorganization of the self that impairs its effectiveness. So it's basically like being all mucked up inside. Like, mm-hmm. It's just, you could call it negative energy, you could call it inconsistencies, you can call it whatever you want. It's just something is not right with yourself inside. So anyway, my point there was that I think that's another reason why some people may not particularly enjoy solitude, or why it would be frightening.
Mm-hmm.
And lastly, I just wanted to point out that solitude is sometimes seen as a bad thing in some cultures. From what I understand, I think we had this conversation before, that there are some parts of the world that when a person is alone, it's sort of looked at as, like, extremely bad, or that they're in, like, utter despair with themselves, or they're completely depressed. And so when somebody goes off by themselves, like, they're almost, like, going off to, like, die. It's kind of funny. I think of the movie Madagascar 2. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I've had the pleasure. But I think of this one part where, I can't even think of the character's names anyway. It's the giraffe. And he's sort of like congregating with the other giraffes. And he's like, they're like, oh, we don't have a doctor. And he's like, so what do you do if you're sick? And he's like, oh, we just wander over to that watering hole and die. So, like, I don't know. Anyway, I kind of think of that, like, so when somebody goes off alone, it's like for a really bad reason.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I can't think of any specific cultures right now, but anyway.
Well, just think about our own culture and mm-hmm. how strange it is if one chooses not to marry and
true.
Live alone.
Very
you
true.
Know, it's not as strange anymore, but at a time, like, if you were an unmarried woman above the age of, like, 20 or something, there was something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you just like being alone, you know? Like,
yeah.
Look at Emily Dickinson, who lived alone and spent all of her time in a cabin. I mean, she probably had some problems, but, you know, I mean, she was all alone and would have her father and I think her sister bring her the necessary things to survive, but she just wanted to be alone and write her poetry and do her thing. And I'm sure that was very strange to the people around her. I mean, I'm not sure, but it must have been, given the time. You know, an unmarried woman writing poetry in a cabin, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, and you wonder if because she was alone like that, she was, like, enabled to be as creative as she was and to become the person that she was. It was, you know, you could almost think of it as like by having like some alone time, you know, however much you need, and I think that's probably different for everyone. I'm sort of losing my train of thought, but yeah, it enabled her to do what she wanted to do. In a way, it sort of increased her chances of autonomy because she was sort of able to reflect and have those creative thoughts.
Right. And I'm sure just in that case, because I know that she was alone all the time, that was probably too much alone time. But, you know, there's probably a reason why she went off to the cabin. But I don't know. You're right. It probably did give her a lot of time to develop her autonomy.
Yeah. Speaking of too much alone time, that sort of brings me to what I was going to say. I was talking about other cultures. Well, in our own culture, in American culture, solitude is sometimes considered a form of punishment. I mean, think of solitary confinement, right? In our prison systems, it basically represents like the harshest, one of the harshest punishments for prisoners who break the rules.
Right.
Like, so for people that aren't behaving in prison, like they are sent to solitary confinement. And you know, obviously that's very, very extreme solitude, but they're locked up in a room the size of a bathroom with no windows for like 23 hours a day, and in that case I would venture to say that that's, way on the extreme end. We probably don't need that much, but and then also the whole concept of time out, right, for children. This discipline strategy that we use with children, typically they are to serve that, like, alone, sometimes facing the corner of the wall or whatever. But, yeah, like, we sort of use solitude, at least this extreme form of it anyway, to punish one another. So, I mean, with this whole idea of culture and, you know, in these examples, it sort of seems like, and again, with the unmarried woman example, like society almost has like this negative connotation attached to solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also interesting, I actually took a gander on Wikipedia and actually looked up the word solitude, and the very first entry kind of surprised me. It was extremely negative, extremely negative. It was solitude is like, and I can't remember the exact word, but basically like it's something that, you know, somebody does because they like have no other choice, almost like as if they were defining solitary confinement. And then there was sort of like a blip, you know, there's like this whole paragraph about how it was kind of negative and bad and whatever. And then there was like a blip underneath about like, well, you know, some do enjoy the their, you know, solitude on the less extreme end to, you know, develop their own meaningful activities or whatever. But anyway, I thought that was kind of interesting too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably time out and solitary confinement is effective to a certain degree. I mean, like, in the case of the children, you know, we're not going to, like, put them in the corner for 18 hours a day. But I remember being sent to my room as a kid and I'm sure that within the first 10 minutes I was fine and having a blast and making up my own games because I was just actively imaginative. But, you know, I think that the idea behind it is to allow the child to have some time to reflect and calm down and think about things. And in my case, I think it worked. But, you know, I wasn't in my room for long periods of time, you know, probably just long enough to have my mom, like, clear her head too. But, yeah, I want to share this story about this woman that I knew, and I know I've told you about her, Amanda, because she was just so interesting to me. She was a graduate from CMU, like, 30 years ago, and after she graduated, she became a cloistered nun, and I don't know if any of our listeners know about what cloistered nuns live like, but they take a vow of silence, and they cover themselves from head to foot, and they spend their day reading the Bible or studying religious texts, and they don't talk. And the only time that they talk is when they're talking about the Bible. And they live alone, and their visitors can see them through, like, plated glass or there's some barrier between them. And they don't get visitors very often, so they're very alone. And this woman lived like this for about 25 years. And she was telling me about how she just absolutely hated it. She started to go crazy. She described it as a punishment more than an opportunity to get in touch with her spirituality. And I think that is probably an individual thing. Maybe some people really do enjoy that drastic lifestyle, but I think that Aristotle said it best when he said that we're social animals. We have to be around other people to a certain degree. And when you think about it, if you're alone all day reading the Bible or reading a book or just anything all day by yourself with your own thoughts and you have negative thoughts, eventually those thoughts are just going to drive you crazy, and that's all that you're going to be able to think about. So she ended up leaving the cloistered nun that she was, or the cloister that she was a part of, and I can't think of the name of it, I guess convent, and now she lives alone, and she works, and she goes out and does things that she wants to do, but she always goes home to her own home, and she still lives alone. But I think that exposing herself to, like, a really social life after all that would be crazy, so I think that she still really enjoys her solitude, but now her solitude has a sense of meaning because she can share it with other people. When she was a nun, she couldn't share her solitude, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
There's things that she can develop while she's alone and then go and discuss these things or share them with
mm-hmm.
her friends. And
mm-hmm.
I think that's meaningful. You have to have some amount of society, I guess, in order to make your life enriching.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Just curious, two things. First of all, how long do you happen to know how long the vow of silence is supposed to be carried out for?
Well, she told me that when she got there, when she first joined, she could talk and ask questions for a couple of months, and then slowly they would take the talking away.
Mm.
And she could only talk to certain people. Like, she could only talk to the nun that was, training her, I guess.
The mentor nun.
Yeah. So she could talk to the mentor nun and ask her questions. And after a certain time period, there was no more talking. They could talk at, like, holidays. Like, they could talk at Christmas and Easter and stuff like that. But other than that, you know, there wasn't very much talking going on.
Hmm. So also, did she happen to mention how long she was in the convent for?
I think it was 25 years.
Okay, 25. Okay. Yeah, and so it took her that long to really second-guess it, or was she second-guessing it for, like, 10 years and just stuck it out?
I don't think it was immediately, but I think that in the case of the convent, you're there for a religious purpose, and I can imagine it. You're living this religious life, and you're feeling all these horrible negative feelings, and you feel like a failure, essentially, because you feel like you should not be feeling this way. You look around and you see that the other nuns are relatively okay, and you have all these negative thoughts, and you feel like, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I devoted myself to God, and this is, her life was her faith. So I'm sure that it took her a long time to finally accept, okay, I can still have faith and live the life I want to have. So I'm sure that there was a big conflict of faith involved there.
And it's kind of ironic because it's almost as if she would have been okay had she been able to express how she felt to the other nuns and maybe received that relatedness component that she was obviously missing out on.
Right, because it is, to me, it is almost ridiculous to assume that someone can live a life of complete solitude. It's unhealthy, and clearly in her case it was very unhealthy.
Very interesting. So I know that the same kind of goes for some Buddhist practices as well. You may have some knowledge of that. I was sort of perusing, I think in Buddhism they call it the noble silence, is it?
Mm-hmm.
The noble silence.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I know a whole lot about that, but I was actually perusing the internet, sort of looking at different websites related to the noble silence, and there was a blog entry. It was someone that had taken a vow of silence sort of underneath the Buddhist practices and sort of blogged about what their his or her experience was like, and it was very interesting. They basically described certain things that they were feeling, and you know, at one point, which was I guess the breaking point, in this case it was a man, he felt very angry And he didn't really elaborate as to why he felt angry, but he sort of, like, couldn't take it anymore. And so he sort of just broke off the silence. But it's interesting. It's very interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I mean, I've never been alone for long periods of time, but I find that after a couple of days of not hanging out with my friends, I just want to hang out with somebody, you
mm-hmm.
know? And, like, loneliness, but solitude is good to a certain point. Again, I'm going to say that again.
Uh-huh.
Because, it is good to a certain point, but eventually the loneliness sets in, and you start questioning things, and you start getting unhappy, and
mm-hmm.
That's when I think solitude can be a frightening concept, once that starts to happen.
Yeah, definitely. And something interesting, sort of an afterthought to the whole Buddhist monk blog, you know, is that against the rules? Like, if you're taking a vow of silence, is it outlawed for you to, like, blog about it? Could you, like, blog your experience to other people, or would that be, like, breaking the code, do you think?
I don't know. We actually just had a listener ask us that in the chat room. I don't know. It might be breaking the code. I'm not familiar with Buddhist practices enough to say.
Yeah, I did find it pretty unusual. And, you know, it may be the case that he attempted this blog only after
mm-hmm.
he sort of broke his vow or what have you. But it's a question that's very interesting and only occurring now with the technology that we have these days. So did you want to say any more on this question?
No, I think we pretty much talked this one to death.
So with that said, how do you think technology has what role does that play in solitude? Has it hindered our ability to find meaning or solace in our alone time, or is it helpful? What do you think?
Well, I think in ways it's helpful. It could be a stimulating way to spend your alone time. Like, you know, looking up podcasts or checking out websites that you think are interesting could be a positive way to spend your solitude. But also, I think that it could be very, it could be harmful. I'm thinking about the case of the people who constantly have their cell phones nearby just waiting for that call, or the people who update their Facebook status 30 times a day. Or the businessman who has to have his BlackBerry on all the time.
Very true.
There's really no alone time when you're always plugged into technology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to reiterate your point, it's so true because people of yesteryear or generations past, however you want to call it, you know, thinking about the generation where they only had a telephone in their house mm-hmm. and they didn't have cell phones. So when they left the house to go run errands or go to work or school or whatever, the phone stayed there, and, like, they were sort of free to pursue whatever it was, whatever goal they had set out for themselves. Whereas today, it's obviously not the case because nearly, you know, I'm going to say most people have cell phones these days. And most people, well, maybe not most people, but, you know, a lot of people are also connected to some social media in some form or another, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever. And, you know, it's just people are just so connected to their social networks on a way greater scale than ever before. They're sort of their, I guess, reachability, if you will, is just so much so much more.
Mm-hmm.
And like you were saying about the businessmen, it's almost like, you know, going back to, like, societal connotations on solitude, it's almost like for the businessmen, like, they're sort of required to be reachable at all times because it's like, okay, like, you know, if you're, like, the businessman who's, like, in sales and, like, you don't answer your phone, like, when a client calls you or something, then what, that client's going to go elsewhere and you've lost the call. Or with other people, I know in my own case, if I don't answer my cell phone, at least with my family, they freak out. Like,
right.
They're like, are you okay? Oh, my gosh, like, you didn't answer your phone. I'm like, I just didn't answer it. Like, I wasn't, like, it's like a huge deal now. It's almost like if we don't stay connected, it's like you're the oddball. And it's interesting because just today, I was in the cafeteria here at school, and I overheard a conversation between a couple of girls, you know, 20, roughly in their 20s, early 20s, I'm guessing, and they were having this, like, heated conversation about, well, the one girl was describing to the other how she has this roommate who is, like, so strange, and how she's, you know, the reason why she is strange is because she's, quote-unquote, antisocial, because she comes home and she goes in her room and she has her, like, own routine that doesn't involve them. And because of that, like, she is antisocial and she is the, she is the butt of their conversation, their gossip. So
I was that girl when I had roommates.
I think that it's, like, it, because that just reinforces the idea that it's, like, a bad thing. Like, you're the strange one if you don't answer your phone or if you don't, like, spend every waking minute with your roommates.
Right, right. And I don't know if that's a problem or not. Maybe it is a problem. Maybe she is spending too much time away from her roommates and she should be socializing a bit more. But I remember one time I was talking to a friend of mine who was angry that her dad never brings his cell phone to work and he drives 2 hours to work every day. And she's like, what's going to happen if he gets like a flat tire on the road? And he said to her, people got flat tires before there were cell phones, and they got through it. So I think that our dependence on technology is almost to the point where we're fearful of not having it near us. We won't be able to cope if we get a flat tire. Well, you know, there were cars before there were cell phones. Mm-hmm. There were flat tires before there were cell phones. So it's kind of interesting how fearful we are to be disconnected. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like we were discussing before the show, like, you know, obviously technology is a very, very hot topic right now in many ways and the whole, like, ethics behind it. And we were just saying, like, you know, okay, so we've got all this social media. We're, like, so connected. Like, what role is that going to – well, not role, but, like, the effects of that after years and years and years, we're sort of, like, so used to this convenience. Like, are we going to become, what, incapable of changing our own flat tires or, like, what, incapable of, like, finding solutions to problems without a cell phone? I don't know.
Right, right.
It's interesting.
And just going back to, like, this social media, these networks that we have online, I don't know about you, but I have 100-some friends on Facebook, and I only talk to, like, 6 of them. And, you know, I don't know 100-and-some people. They're just my friends on Facebook. So I don't really need to spend my time, like, checking their photos and stuff like that. And to me, those are the superficial relationships that really don't matter that much. So why spend time trying to feel connected to relationships that really don't really matter that much anyways? It's almost like we'd rather be connected to superficiality than no connection at all. It's kind of a strange concept that that our generation is dealing with.
Yeah, and getting back to the whole Facebook thing or any or the cell phone or whatever. So, you know, here you are and you're trying to do something, you're trying to get something done. Say you're trying to do your homework and somebody is texting you, somebody is calling you, somebody is like IMing you or whatever it is. Like that part of technology, I would say that would be like the downside because you're so connected and because it's such a distraction that it's literally taking away from your flow experience.
Right.
So almost making it really hard to have one. I mean, I know some people can sort of block that out, but at least in my experience, it's really, like, it would be really, really hard for me to block it out. Like, and I know that some people go as far as to, like, turn off their cell phones, they turn off their internet. I know Sandra was just talking about how she made a conscious decision to get rid of the internet in her apartment because of that reason, because she didn't want to find herself searching aimlessly on the internet. And so I know that more and more people are talking about that now. We have to unplug. And I guess that's something that we have to learn to adapt to now.
Right, and I'm sure that it's difficult at first, you know, like whenever I'm studying, my cell phone goes on silent and I don't check it while I'm studying. I'll check it on my study breaks because I know that if it's ringing, I'm going to be tempted to answer it, and I don't want to. Like if I wanted to talk to you, I would call you or I would answer when I'm available to. So whenever I study, it's on silent and Facebook is off, and sometimes it is really hard not to check email or check Facebook and stuff like that. So I think that it's almost a little bit frightening to me how hard it is to disconnect for some people. And for me, it's difficult at times. But, like, after programming myself not to do it, it's not as tempting anymore. But it was hard at first to, like, disconnect, which is really weird.
Yeah. I know for me, I experienced a really busy semester just a year ago, actually, just this past fall. And I had Facebook and MySpace and whatever else, and I actually made the conscious decision to deactivate my Facebook. Not that I was a chronic Facebook user who was spending hours and hours on Facebook, but because I didn't even want the temptation, because quite frankly, at the time, I couldn't afford to spare even an hour on Facebook, and I didn't want the temptation, and so I just got rid of it, and I still don't have it. But it's sad because, you know, I'm often confronted with other people, and Facebook, you know, comes up, you know, periodically, and, you know, people ask me, oh, do you have Facebook so we can get in touch? No, I deactivated it. Oh, really? That's so strange. Well, not really. And, you know, it's almost like people start to make you feel like you're sort of obligated to have it. I mean, at one point I was like, well, maybe I should get one back because of the social aspect and because it is a good networking tool. But I'm just not ready to do it yet.
Right. And you don't really need to. I mean, Facebook can also be detrimental in some ways. But I have a friend who was talking to me the other day about how he was in Chicago, and he looked around him and saw dozens of people on their iPhones, like messing around on their iPhones, and he's like, it was disgusting. Like, they were in a group of people, and they needed to be connected to other people and other things, which is so strange to me. I mean, and that just goes to show that, like, you can feel a sense of loneliness when you are even in a group of people. You have to be connected somehow.
So true. Also, I happen to notice today, as a matter of fact, as I'm combing through NPR, I happen to notice a title of an article that I tried to read, but I couldn't because the internet had failed me. But it basically, the headline was, you know, cell phone usage while driving causes, you know, numerous accidents or whatever. And, you know, I wanted to read and find out, like, you know, is this on the rise? I mean, I'm guessing it probably is. But, you know, even when you're driving, people feel compelled to text and chat. And you can't just, like, shut it off just to, like, engage with the activity. Yeah, and I know another article that I had read, one girl was interviewed, teenage girl. It was related to Twitter. But they were interviewing her. She didn't use Twitter, but she did, however, send 200 text messages a day.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so that, you know, that was kind of astounding to me, but
yeah. That
there you go again. That's just another example.
Right. Well, I live in Minnesota, and I make the drive home a couple times a year, and I drive through the Upper Peninsula, and my cell phone is, like, out of range for, like, a good 8 hours. And those are my favorite 8 hours of the trip because I'm not tempted to call anyone, and I'm not tempted to answer, and I can just drive and think about things. And it's so relaxing for me, but I hear from people that it's pretty crazy that I can go 8 hours alone in a car, but I like it. I think it's relaxing.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm a student who commutes, and I commute about 2 hours to school and back to home, and quite frankly, every time I tell people that, they're always like, oh, wow, that, you know, don't you hate that? Don't you just loathe it? And I really don't. I mean, I actually find it to be kind of enjoyable because, like you said, I sit back, I drive. A lot of times I listen to music or a podcast or something stimulating and exciting, and that's good enough for me, and I'm actually getting something out of it.
Right. You're making that alone time meaningful and sometimes educational, and I think that's great. Amanda, I'm going to ask you a question about your summer. You spent the summer in France studying abroad, and I'm sure that at times you were alone, and did you find ways to fill your alone time?
Actually, yes, you are correct. The reason for my absence on the show, I have been studying abroad in France this past summer, and yes, you are correct. I did experience many times being alone and able to enjoy my own solitude. Basically, I went there to study the language and sort of immerse myself in the culture. and definitely learned a lot about myself, I have to say. Just living without the people who normally support you, your family, friends, whatever, the people you have, that close unit that you're used to, definitely takes some adjustment. Not to say that I can't live without them, but, you know, you're used to something and you're sort of like getting sort of getting used to it.
Yeah.
I can't think of a better way to put it right now. But, but yeah, so you're sort of untraining yourself from what you're normally used to. And, yes, while abroad, I met very many interesting people. I got to experience conversations with many people from different cultures and different aspects. But at the same time, I did also have a lot of time in my own solitude. And I like to think of it as the opportunity I had to sort of get to know myself better.
Mm-hmm.
Almost as if you were getting to know somebody else. Mm-hmm. You're getting to know yourself in a way, I guess is the best way I could explain it. I mean, in essence, when you're alone, you're spending time with yourself, and during that time, you're sort of free to reflect on your life experiences. So what I mean by that is, like, take, for example, the events of the day. At the end of the day, you're thinking, this is what happened today, these are the people I encountered, this is the way that I interacted and responded, and was that appropriate? Was that concordant with my own identity of myself? Another way of putting it is that it's like an opportunity to have a self-check. I guess it's a perfect opportunity to ask yourself the why question, the tombstone question, like, what are we here for? Am I treating other people the way I want to treat them? Are they getting from me what they need to get from me? Am I acting the way that I think I should be acting? You definitely have more of an opportunity to do that when you're alone, and that's obviously important. So I think that by having that self-reflection and that self-examination, it also sort of equips you with the tools to deal with the stress of the day.
Mm-hmm.
You can sort of take it apart and understand what happened and why. And because of that, the next day you're better able to handle, and you've asked yourself the question, and you're sort of refreshed for the day, for the next day, so that the next day, if you didn't live yesterday like the way you wanted it, you can live tomorrow the way you want it. And so I think that's where it's really important. Does any of this ring true for your own solitude?
Yeah, I think so. And I think just what you were saying about how you have time to reflect on the events of the day.
Mm-hmm.
I live alone, and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, when I'm, like, doing my nightly routine and getting ready for bed and everything, I do think about what did I do today? What did I learn? How was my day in accordance with who I want to be? And I think that that's a good thing, because then, you know, you have time to reflect and think about things, and that's where the necessity of solitude comes in, and you know, you have time to just reconnect with yourself, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, during the day we're bombarded with all these external things that we have to do and people that we have to see and hang out with and go to class with and everything, and you don't really have time to just think about the actions that you're making and you know, the why question.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I need a little bit of alone time every day, and I love it. Because I have to think about these things for myself. But I think everything that you just said was great.
Mm-hmm.
It really sums up why solitude can be a healthy thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another thing, you have the opportunity, I mean, more than ever, when you're alone, to experience flow states.
Mm-hmm.
Or sort of set yourself up for a flow state. Something that, you know, being out of my element, of course, I was sort of forced to come up with things to do that I find enjoyable. And one thing that I did was I rented a bike. And it was sort of a good option because of the, you know, quite frankly, the price of it was so great. But anyway, I rented a bike. And the place that I lived in France, a town, a city called Annecy, And in this town, there is a very beautiful lake surrounded by mountains and very cute little, very French homes. And so something that I did pretty much daily was I would get up and I would go for a ride around the lake because they had a very nice bike path cleared out for you. And it was, like, most definitely my favorite part of the day. The lake and the mountains and the sun and the clouds and the nature, it was so gorgeous. And, I mean, that just conduced to having, like, an amazing flow experience. And it just totally enabled me to reflect and, like, what I was thinking and feeling. And, yeah, it was definitely my most favorite part of the day. And I would so much rather have done that than sit at my home watching TV or, you know, whatever. I guess that's me personally. But, I mean, I feel like I got a chance to interact with nature. So I enjoyed that.
So basically, in order to make sense of your solitude, you set up a routine for yourself.
Most definitely. Mm-hmm. Most definitely. And more, I'm finding that yet you can tire of routine and structure. You sort of miss it when it's gone. So, you know, I've had many conversations with people where they go through their week and it's structured and they have this schedule. And then on the weekend, usually Sunday afternoon, people are like, they have this like afternoon of free time and they're like, what do I do with it? And that's usually a lot of times people tell me that's when they feel like crap. They feel like crap. They're like, you know, I have nothing to do. You know, I haven't been pursuing this, like, meaningful activity in my spare time. And so, you know, I'm like, hesitant to start something. And so they're sort of stuck in this rut of boredom. And I think that's where a lot of people are defaulting to passive activities.
Right, right. I would totally agree with that. And it's because I think that, you know, like you go through the week and you have your structure and then Friday night you're like, woo, time to relax. And then Saturday mm-hmm. you're still in the time to relax mode. And then Sunday, you know, you don't have anything to do to fill that time. You're not going to go out partying because you got to wake up the next day. And so, you know, your friends are all studying or whatever. What are you going to do? You have to find something that's meaningful. And I would definitely agree that routine, while it can seem constricting, is really beneficial. Like this summer, I took classes at the beginning of summer, and then the rest of the summer I was just hanging out in Mount Pleasant trying to fill my time. And by the end of July, I was like ready for routine again, and I could mm-hmm. not wait to get back to class. And I mean, I still found ways to make this summer really meaningful,
mm-hmm.
and I had a great summer, but by the end of it, I was ready, and I was set for classes, and
mm-hmm.
it's good to be back in a routine.
Yeah, I mean, because you can really only spin your wheels for so long, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, you want to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so by setting that, like, structure and routine, I mean, at least right now, I can't really see any other way to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something else I want to bring up is that in this chapter that we keep referring to in Flow, there are a couple examples of some people in their solitude and sort of, like, what they do. There was one woman that was talked about named Dorothy, who originally had a husband, rather, and a couple of kids and something of that nature, typical. But the family life sort of, like, went away. I think it was the case that her husband had passed away
mm-hmm.
and the children were, you know, grown up and moved out or whatever. And she had actually took it upon herself to move away to this tiny island sort of in, like, northern Minnesota on the border of Canada. And she sort of, like, moved herself out into the wilderness and lived in this little cabin by a lake. And she would enjoy a summer of social activity between her and the fishermen that would come by, though, I mean, limited still as compared to, like, life in the city.
Right.
But when the winter came, the fishermen had since gone, and it was basically her alone in the wilderness. And what she did is she imposed a routine on herself. And quite frankly, yeah, it was very structured. I'll just read to you a passage here. It says, More important than structuring space, perhaps, is structuring time. Dorsey has strict routines for every day of the year. Up by 5, check the hens for eggs, milk the goat, split some wood, make breakfast, wash, sew, fish, and so on. So, yeah, Dorsey had it going on. Like, she had stuff to do. Like, she definitely wasn't just sitting around passively. She imposed this routine on herself, and she really appreciated it. It says here, in the long evenings, when she didn't have anything to do, she would spend her time reading and writing. And so she was really trying to find ways to stimulate herself, all of her needs. And I think in the passage here, it says she wouldn't have it any other way.
That's really crazy to me, but it sounds like a different century almost.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a caller, so I'm going to take that, and hello?
Hello?
Hi, caller.
Hi, great show, guys. Hey, just, I didn't catch it, but were you reading, as Dorsey mentioned in Flow?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So it's funny, because I'm sitting here, and I have a passage, and it's not from Flow, but it's actually from Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, and he actually has his routine, or he's recorded for us, for posterity, his routine. And it's really great because not only does he incorporate order into his day, but also going back to, Amanda, your point about how the solitude that you experienced in France allowed you to reflect on the day. And I just want to read you, this is Benjamin Franklin. So he wakes up at 4:30 a.m., and he says, 4:30 a.m. to 7:30 a.m., rise, wash, and address powerful goodness, contrive day's business, and take the resolution of the day, prosecute the present study and breakfast, then 8 to 12, work, so it's 4 hours, then 12 to 2, I guess this is his playtime, read, overlook my accounts, and dine. Then 2 to 6, work. Then 6 to 10, I love this, put things in their places.
Wow.
Supper, music or diversion or conversation, examination of the day, and then 10 to 4:30 a.m., sleep. So I just want to make the point that, to just incorporate both of the things that you guys have been talking about, there's this reflection that is really, really crucial to solitude. There's the building of the skills that you talked about in the beginning of the show. So when Franklin is talking about work, he's spending 8 hours a day on work. He's presumably, developing his skills, doing his science and so forth. And it's all in one day, and it's a very scheduled routine. So you have all of that stuff going on, the scheduled routine, the building of the skills within it, and the reflection at the end of the day. So I just wanted to give it up to Ben Franklin and leave it at that, and that was really all I had to say. So, great show, guys. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Well, what do you think of Ben Franklin's day?
Sounds a lot like Dorothy's. I think that it is important when facing solitude in order to avoid the negative thoughts or the boredom or whatever to have structure, and obviously Dorothy and Ben are really focused on strict structure.
Well, talk about not feeling unsure of what to do because, we've talked on this show before about setting yourself up for, like, automatic behaviors and sort of running on automatic so that you have to make less trivial choices throughout the day about, like, what to do next. If you have that structure, you're, again, free to do whatever and getting, each activity fulfilled, and that's where you're going to grow and your complexity gain. Actually, it's a point I wanted to make about complexity and the growth of the self. There's actually a part, and this isn't from the chapter that we've been discussing, but in another part of Flow where the author discusses the idea of complexity and the growth of the self. And he describes complexity as is basically developing skills, That's sort of how you gain complexity of yourself. And I think growth of the self is probably self-explanatory. But what he says is that there are really two components to make sure that that is happening. He says the first is differentiation, and the second is integration.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he's using those words in a technical way. What he means and what he says he means by differentiation is, in essence, fulfilling the social need that we have as human beings. That's basically what it boils down to. He's basically saying, yes, there is this social need that we have, and we need to fulfill it. And the integration component is really solitude.
Mm-hmm.
And he's saying, yes, we are social beings, but we also need to have this element of solitude. And he puts it another way, but that is basically what he is saying. And really, without both components, you will not have, you will not gain complexity and grow ultimately as a person.
Right, and I think that goes back to the story about the cloistered nun,
mm-hmm.
who needed to share her solitude with other people and bring that solitude
mm-hmm.
in with a social group.
Mm-hmm.
In order to grow and feel more complex and
mm-hmm.
give herself meaning, because if all that you're doing is spending your time by yourself and you have no one to share it with, as social animals, we have to seek out meaning in some way. And I think that a lot of meaning does come from other people.
Yeah, and it seems to be the case now as we're bringing this all together. We've got, and with 3 minutes remaining in the show, we made the example about at the beginning about the people who are almost overindulgent in their social happenings, if you will. And then you have the cloistered nun, or like people in solitary confinement, on the opposite end of the extreme. And I guess really what we're talking about here is, again, and it's a reoccurring theme in our show, it's sort of like the moderate path,
mm-hmm.
Really incorporating both components in order to have the complexity, gain the complexity, and grow as a person. So, yeah.
All right. Well, we have another caller, so I'm going to take that. We have about 2 minutes left, so... Hello, caller.
Yes, hi.
My
name is Phil. I'm in the chat room with the name Jersey Phil.
Oh,
and,
great.
I'm a little bit late. I thought this was going to be tomorrow night, and so I was just checking my email and discovered that it's tonight. So, but I was very interested in the topic, and as I mentioned in the chat room, I'm a jogger, and I'm an old guy, and I did short distance running years ago, but I've gotten into long distance running, like half marathons, later in life. And you talk about solitude; it's a great experience after you run 4 or 5 miles and out on a country road. And you know, I try not to to think about too much. But I have so many creative thoughts after a few miles. It's amazing. My thinking clears, and they're not negative thoughts, the kind I have during the day at work. But I've just discovered this in the last couple of years and thought I'd like to share it with the group here.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I can concur with that. I feel the same way. With activities that I do, riding a bike, I mentioned in the show earlier, it really does help you to think clearly.
Yeah, I missed that. So sorry I got here kind of late.
Oh, that's fine.
So,
no, we're glad to have you on and sharing your experience.
All
right. Was there any final thought or
leave
that's it at
it.
That?
Nice to meet you all. Yeah.
Well,
bye-bye.
We have about 60 seconds left, but... Oh, did we lose our caller?
Yeah, I think we lost him.
Okay. Well, never mind.
any kind of interesting question that we can pose to our listeners for themselves? Is that what you were getting at?
Well, no, but I guess I can think of one. I guess my challenge for the listeners, for this week. That's a new thing I'm going to do, challenge the listeners. Let's try and figure out ways that we can make our solitude meaningful this week and induce some flow activities in our own lives.
So if that means starting something that takes some energy, start it now and then gain that complexity week by week.
Mm-hmm. That's build good habits.
I would add that as well.
All right. Well, thanks for listening. And, again, we are switching our shows Tuesday. Next week is kind of up in the air because we have a special guest coming to CMU. But we will let you all know via our website, ethicstalk.cmish.edu.
All right. So look for us next week. Thank you.